Hi, welcome to Who Was Cesar Chavez, sponsored by the Farmworker Movement Documentation Project. My name is Ray Tejas, moderator, and our guest today is Larry Tramatola, a volunteer with the United Farm Workers and a friend and associate of Cesar Chavez from 1971 to 1981 approximately. And today Mr. Tramatola is the president of a political consulting firm headquartered in Oakland, California, the Tramatola Company. Is that pretty accurate?
Yes.
Larry, a little background here to just kind of figure out, you know, how you came to the farm workers movement. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about how did it happen? What were you doing?
Well, there was no plan. I think my history and my story is probably similar to many others. The only thing that makes mine different is I stayed for probably a longer period of time than hundreds of other volunteers who contributed what they could to the movement. But for me, it started by being a volunteer on the Great Boycott early on when I was in college. And I never thought of it as something that I would do proactively, meaning spend a lot of time at it. It was something I could do on weekends or in the evenings and do things. And in the period of time that I was in college, there was a great deal of social unrest. The Vietnam War, civil rights movement, assassination of Martin Luther King and Kennedy. And I think anybody in college who had a brain was thinking about major issues that perhaps previous generations or future generations wasn't thinking about. When I graduated, I struggled with what I was going to do. And I thought that maybe what I would do was go on to law school and become a lawyer and do poverty law or do some sort of socially good law work. And so I got a internship at San Mateo Legal Aid in Redwood City. And it was not too long thereafter that I realized that I didn't have the temperament to be an attorney. I was more interested in action than I was in research. I was more interested in change on a broader scale than change on an individual scale. And so I began looking around at where I could learn how to become an organizer. And really in the country, there were only two places that I could find that were doing significant organizing. One was in Chicago with Saul Alinsky doing different things there, and I had no interest in going to Chicago. And the other one was in California, and it was the farmworker movement led by Caesar. And that really was a draw. And so one weekend I had, as I had done in the past, collected food and support for farm workers who at that point were on strike in the lettuce in Salinas. And I brought a load of food down to the UFW headquarters. Still at this point was not thinking about anything other than volunteering and helping on the weekend. But I happened to go in the UFW headquarters, and there was a meeting going on talking about the strike, and things were, at that era, totally open. I mean, there weren't closed-door meetings. There weren't, you know, it was like you were there, and you could see decision-making process going on from the top levels of the UFW, Marshall Gantz, Fred Ross, and others, with strikers and trying to figure out what they were going to do. And, you know, I'm bringing this load of food in, and I'm kind of watching this going on. I stuck around, and I watched this older man in the corner kind of taking it all in, every now and then offering very pithy, smart comments about organizing. And I was intrigued with this guy. I unloaded the food. I think I got something to eat and got my car and stopped at a Foster Freeze, which I still go to, these ice cream places. And I ran into this guy who turns out to be Fred Ross. And so I introduced myself. I said I'd seen him at the meeting. He asked me why I'd come down. And we just started a conversation. And he was talking about the strike and organizing. And I asked him, I said, you know, is there a career with organizers and stuff? And he said, oh, yeah. And then he said that lots of people are interested. Very few can make it. And if I wanted to talk more about organizing, he was writing a book in San Francisco. He lived in Bernal Heights. and to give him a call. So as I drove back up to Palo Alto, I kept thinking about it, and I thought, wow, I want to talk to this guy. So I called him up a couple of days later, and he said, yeah, come on over. And so I went over to his house, and I don't know how old Fred was at that point. I mean, I was probably 22. Fred probably was in his mid-60s then. He had already had his career. He had trained Caesar. He had done all this organizing. He'd done all this stuff beforehand. And so I went to his house in Bernal Heights, and it was covered with papers all over the place. I mean, putting organizer and Fred in the same sentence kind of was crazy, because he seemed to be so disorganized in terms of his writing, in terms of what he was doing. And he actually wrote left-handed, and he was scribbling by hand his recollections of the first time he had met Caesar. And he showed me his original notes when he met Caesar for the first time. And in his notes, it was, I think I have found the person that I've always been looking for. Which was like, wow. And then he was describing his first campaign with Caesar, which was in Oxnard. But he had pictures all around and stuff. And he talked for an hour, hour and a half about his early days with Caesar and about what he had done in the 50s organizing Hispanics in L.A. and in other places. And I was just fascinated by this guy. And, I mean, truly fascinated. He was somebody I had gone through Stanford. I had had great professors. There's nobody that was interesting and as intriguing and as powerful as this guy. And just by telling stories about what he had done and stuff. And he kind of turned to me and said, are you interested in organizing? I said, I'm very interested. He said, well, if you're interested, there's a place for you here, but it's hard work. And let me tell you that the failure rate is great. So that was it. The next day I started, they needed somebody in Santa Clara County, and I started working, and really for 6 months I worked under his thumb, really, where it was, I was in the boycott, and we were trying to build support in the urban area for the farm workers, as many people had done, but I was kind of like the only one initially. He gave me contacts. Were in Catholic churches of people I could talk to, but basically I was responsible for building support in the Santa Clara County area for the farm workers. It wasn't glamorous, it wasn't in the fields organizing workers, it was just really tough boycott work.
Now, when Fred said, this is a guy, I think I found the guy.
About Caesar.
What do you think he meant?
Well, even at that point in time, Caesar was, for me and for anybody else, this is 1971, already a legend. I mean, he had already gotten into the almost a mythical figure. Although he was real, he had gotten to that point. So, you know, my image of Caesar was this big, powerful man who always knew what he wanted to do. And what Fred told me was that he was a young punk kid, really, in San Jose that was curious more than anything else. But his curiosity and his willingness to take action to improve a community were kind of qualities that Fred had been looking for. And so when Fred described Caesar, it was almost as though he was describing something that other people could do. You know, he wasn't describing a mythical figure. He wasn't describing somebody outside of being. He was describing a real human being, and in doing that, Fred was trying to organize me or whoever it was. It happened to me in that situation, but I could see how Fred had worked his magic to inspire Caesar to do something.
So now, Fred, you know, trained a lot of people. He worked very closely with Caesar. He mentored Caesar in a lot of ways. But what about with you? What was your relationship with Fred?
Well, I was as close to my father as a son could be, but Fred rivaled that, to be honest with you. And I can't think of Fred in any way other than just being, it's almost like talking about family. I worked closely with him for all the years I was in the UFW. He was always my mentor.
I'm sorry. You were talking about Fred. The fact is, you worked closely with him. What was that relationship that you guys?
He obviously was able to have an influence on me at a critical point in my life where I was looking for direction for career, and I don't mean a career in terms of making money. It was a career in terms of how did I want to spend my life? What was the contribution I was going to make to the world? And Fred filled that with guidance, with challenge, discipline, every emotion that you would go through to try to be successful. Fred was there. I mean, at various times where, you know, my first few years in the UFW were difficult. I broke up with a girlfriend I had for a long time. Fred was critical in getting me to see the bigger picture about investment of life, and that he encouraged me to go to Mexico to learn to speak Spanish. Which I thought was interesting because he never really learned to speak Spanish and was remarkably successful organizing among the Latino community, but he encouraged me to do that. He was always there when I had a question, always. The discipline that he had in training me as an organizer, I benefited from all my life. I mean, everything that I do today, I look back and say, if it hadn't been for Caesar, it hadn't been for Fred, I could never do what I do today. I can't give him enough credit. He really got me to understand the importance of discipline and hard work, and the importance of story, the importance of laughter, all those emotions that you use to organize people. Remarkable man. Remarkable. And unfortunately, someone has not done a real... His impact in California is... You can't measure it, really, from my perspective. And for somebody that has had the impact he has had, no one has really done a credible biography. He gets lost in some ways. He gets lost in the story of Cesar Chavez. He gets lost in the story of the farm worker movement. And he, on his own, contributed so much. It's a tragedy that somebody hasn't written more about it. Truly remarkable individual.
Okay, now we're going to transition right now into another segment. Okay, actually, is Fred Ross. We've done some taping with us. Okay. Now, tell me, Larry. Fred Ross was instrumental in getting you, roping you in, mm-hmm. and training you. Now, what happened when you first encountered Caesar? When you first met him?
Everybody think I had this image of him. I was surprised he was so small, even though I had read he was small. I was surprised his hands were so little, and I was surprised that he was so meek. In person. That was my first impression. Once I got to know him, I had a totally different impression. I mean, how powerful he was, how he could command a room. Although he could walk into a room and, I don't know, I was going to say he could walk in a room and no one would know who he was there. He was already to the point that everybody knew who he was, so he commanded the room. But he had that kind of personality that if you didn't know who he was and you didn't know what he looked like, he could kind of come into a room and just kind of be in a corner. No one would really know who he was until he spoke, until he talked. And he was remarkable. I mean, I should say at the outset of this interview, there were good parts and there were bad parts, and I experienced both with him. I mean, I think as I look back at it now 20 years later, the good parts far outnumbered the bad parts. And even though there's a legacy of the unfortunately, there's not enough organizing going on, being going on to farm workers now, and you can lay a lot of that onto Caesar. Nevertheless, what he was able to accomplish, given the point in history, was truly remarkable.
Well, let's talk about the good and let's talk about the bad. I mean, Caesar has been criticized for stopping, not organizing, going direct to direct mail and other things at a very critical point in the Union's development. How do you see it?
Well, I think I would share that criticism. I maybe explain it a little bit differently than others. I looked at Caesar as one of the most curious people I had ever met. And I can see how his curiosity and his willingness to use that curiosity for social change, for organizing people, made him so successful. Here was a guy who went to the eighth grade. His library would dwarf many city libraries now. He read voraciously. And he read things, he may have read novels, I don't know, but he read management books. He read books about labor history. He read books about leaders. He read books about spiritual issues. The guy's intellect and curiosity was awesome. And I don't think that has been written much about him. But his curiosity and his interest in things led him to various things that other people didn't normally delve into. Management theories. Christ sakes, you're a labor leader and you're reading Peter Drucker on management theories and you're trying to apply management theories to the structure of the union, and you're trying to get people to understand about management and administration and financial management when they're interested in you know, the social causes and the boycotts and strikes and all that. I mean, it was truly remarkable. He was interested in spiritual things, which took him down a path that most people don't go down. He was interested in organic gardening. It took him down a path about sustainability and communities. His curiosity was one of his strengths, and it could be said, I think, his curiosity took him down some paths that perhaps were not in the best interest of the union, but that happens with very talented, creative, intellectually stimulating people. And I think that happened.
And it happened more than once?
Happened all the time. I mean, I think Caesar was probably curious from a very young age. His curiosity led him to listen to Fred Ross when in the first meeting with Fred Ross, he was going to try to, you know, beat the crap out of him. But his curiosity took over from his machismo, you know, and he listened. And it was because of that curiosity. But my theory is, in some ways, is his curiosity also took him down a lot of other paths, which maybe were helpful to the union, maybe not. And other people had a hard time keeping up because you never know where Caesar was going to be. Caesar was always kind of out there ahead of others on thinking about a lot of different kinds of things. I mean, even to think that, I mean, you look at, I was very critical of the direct mail stuff, and I was very critical of I was critical of dismantling this very successful boycott operation and putting the resources in direct mail. But you look at where most unions are today, and most unions are doing that kind of stuff. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know. But Caesar was way ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And sometimes when you're ahead of your time, that's not a good thing. But I think his curiosity was a strength all in all. And it was, you know, when Caesar inspired people. Caesar inspired people who went to Cal or Stanford or Berkeley or Harvard. But he also inspired farm workers who had lived in farm worker communities their whole life. He inspired middle-class people and poor people at all levels. And why? Because he was able to relate to them. And I think he was able to relate to them partly because of intellectual curiosity and be able to draw in stories that were meaningful to people. He could talk to religious people, and because he was widely, had read well among religious texts, he could speak to them in language that they understand. The same with labor leaders. He could talk about John L. Lewis and tell you about John L. Lewis, and it would rival somebody who's teaching labor studies at Cal. I mean, all that was a good thing, but it also had its downside because he may go in a direction that maybe wasn't, in the long run, healthy for the union or healthy for the growth of the union.
Okay. Now, you worked closely with him, with Caesar. What was it like to work with somebody who I assume was pretty demanding?
Caesar was very demanding. I mean, my staff today is always amazed at my own work discipline, where I can work 7 days a week on days at a time. But that was common in the UFW. It's rare outside the UFW, but it was common within the UFW. And when we were living in La Paz, which was the UFW headquarters, now I could get up at 6 and go to the office, and there was a good chance Caesar was already there. I could leave at 8 at 9, a good chance. There was always a chance that Caesar was still working, somebody meeting in his office. His work day was the day, whatever it took. And through his example, others adopted that. So that became the UFW kind of deal. I mean, Leroy was part of that. Marshall Gantz. Everybody had that kind of work ethic that was you never saw anywhere else, and you still don't see today. Where that came from, I have no idea. But his work ethic was unbelievable. He also, though, had the ability to have fun. He was a good dancer. He loved music. He listened to all kinds of music, from classical music to, corridos. And he did it all. I mean, that, again, you see this curiosity. He wasn't locked into one thing or another. We would go sometimes at 11 o'clock at night and go play handball in Bakersfield.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about going 11 o'clock at night to play handball.
Well, there were a couple of reasons for it. First, we were in La Paz, and Bakersfield was the closest place, about an hour away, that you could go, and they had handball courts, outside handball courts. But in the summertime, it's hot during the day. I mean, it's over 100 and stuff. So there's a reason to go at night. But there was another reason, and that was there wouldn't be crowds. If Caesar came, there wouldn't be crowds of people that would come, which would happen with Caesar often. And the need for security was lessened, so you could go with fewer security guards. And we would go at 11 o'clock at night, 11:30, and play till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, play handball on outside courts. And I got to know a lot about Caesar playing handball with him, because he argued every point. There wasn't okay, give me this one, I'll give you the next one. He argued every one. He wasn't above cheating every now and then, or miss, in my head, or, if he was behind me, what were you even? I mean, and it was all in good fun, but he loved to win. And you had to be on top of your game to really win. And he was pretty good at it. He was pretty agile for his age and his size, and he was pretty good. And but it was really neat, because during the times we went, we could sit in the car driving down or driving back, and I had, an hour of uninterrupted time to be able to ask him about questions about organizing or, how to do things. And he was just so easy to talk to. And not talking, with Fred, Fred and Caesar had different kind of ways of organizing. Fred was more of a purist, and Fred was more of a tactician and a scientist in some way. So if there's a science of organizing, Fred was a scientist. Caesar was more of an artist. So, you know, on how he did it, it didn't all necessarily follow a rote pattern as it did with Fred. And I think with Fred, because he was always trying to teach somebody, okay, how do you break this down into the 10 steps, the 9 steps to do it? Caesar was more organic, and he loved telling stories. And he was really good telling a story to get you to think about a way and get you to take action. But it wasn't the formulaic in some ways that Fred had. It was very more thinking broader.
Okay. Caesar's approach to handball, how did that carry through in other aspects? What did it say about him?
The guy was driven to win. He really was. I mean, and it was, I never felt that Caesar was doing it for winning for himself. You know, a lot of people in life are driven, and usually it's driven for monetary reasons in our society. Caesar was really driven about accomplishing something significant for people. Now, his ego was not necessarily always put aside, you know. I mean, I'm sure he enjoyed in many ways, he enjoyed the recognition. He enjoyed the attention. He enjoyed the ability that he could call the governor or the president or whoever and get his calls answered and all of that. But he also wasn't driven by money. He was driven by empowering people. And through empowering people, in some ways, he became even more powerful himself. But that drive to win, to me, was something I would never have seen had I played handball with him. And seeing how there's not a lot of strategy in handball. There's a little strategy, but how he never gave up. He never gave up. I mean, you could be, if we were playing to 15, you could be beating him, which didn't happen very often, you know, 11 to 2, and he was still, it wasn't like I'm giving up this game to fight the next one. It was like every point, everything is challenged. And that to me was a special quality, and a quality that I never would have seen in other aspects.
Now, you must have been pretty competitive yourself. I mean, was he more competitive than you, or were you close to?
To beat Caesar was like the ultimate, you know. I mean, you know, working in the UFW, you were not going to beat Caesar in anything. You were not going to beat Caesar in a conversation or in strategy or, you know, what we were going to have for dinner or anything else. I mean, he ruled the roost. So in a competitive environment, if you were so lucky to win, you know, that was the ultimate, because it wasn't going to happen anywhere else. He was not somebody that back down from an argument or back down from his position he had, and others would criticize in terms of when critical decisions came in the union, whether we were going to pay staff, whether we were going to, you know, Caesar took a very rigid position, but that was his makeup.
Yeah, but how was he with you and some of the other folks, some of the individuals on a day-to-day basis? Was he easy to work with?
He was demanding. He was demanding. I don't think that I can't ever say back that he was easy to work with. I think that he was inspiring. You always wanted to be in a meeting where Caesar was, because there was always something that he was pushing you intellectually, demanding things of you, helping. You know, we were all pretty average people, I think. I mean, I look back at it, I think the UFW did attract a lot of people, and the people that stayed, they had a lot of talent and they were attracted, but on the other hand, we were all pretty average people. We weren't superstars by any stretch. And he was able in some ways to say to each of us in his own way, you can make a huge difference if you apply your time and your life into making a difference. But it starts with you first. What commitment are you making? You can't demand things from people. You can't demand they do things if you're unwilling to do it. I mean, that was what a great message politically for me, as I've done in another political career. I don't ask people to go door to door if I haven't been able to do it or not doing it. And so being able to teach people from having done it yourself, and I think that was a great lesson. But his work ethic was just staggering.
Okay. We're going to transition segment now. Okay. Now, Larry, you mentioned that Caesar liked to have fun. And I understand he liked parties and pageantry and celebrations and that kind of stuff. In your experience, what did you see?
Well, I'll make it real personal. My wife and I got married there. We had already had two children, and we had never really had time to get married. I mean, it was like we were working all the time, you know, that the concept of even having a wedding and all of that was like so bizarre and so not even possible. And Helen Chavez, Caesar's wife, just kept saying, "You guys need to get married. I will do all the food. I will do everything. You guys set a date. We'll make it all happen." And so we did. I mean, we did. We had, and our wedding was really a turning point at La Paz for community events. Because Annie and I both have Italian-American origins, and we wanted to kind of have a large Italian wedding. Now, this, you know, it was a Mexican community and a mix of other things, but we wanted to have Italian wedding. We wanted, all the events up to that point in time had been like buffets, you know, cafeteria line, people got their food and sat down, and there was always music and stuff. And all the weddings there also follow that tradition. We wanted to have a sit-down meal. We wanted to have people served. We wanted to have people relax and just have course after course after course and have music. And that's what we did. And Helen did prepare all the food for, I don't know, a couple hundred people. She and Esther Padilla and a few other people at La Paz prepared all the food. She prepared some of our old Italian recipes. They did all of it. And we got, I think, about 12 of the guys that worked at La Paz served as waiters. And it was the first time in the history of the UFW there was actually a sit-down meal. And Caesar loved it. It really opened his eyes to how you can accomplish some things in a different way. He loved that. He loved that event. He always said later it was the best wedding he had ever gone to. It was the best wedding. But it was just moving it from being more like a cattle call and a buffet into where people were actually treated with dignity at a dinner. And it wasn't something we had ever thought about beforehand. It was just something that happened. And he just partied the whole night. And he had all the weddings he did. But that one was a little different. And I probably remember it more because it was my wedding. But that we talked about it many times afterwards, that was the way you really get people to relax and to quiet down and to engage each other in conversations. And it was pretty neat.
What was it about? Was it a point in his life where he was ready to kind of click into that? It sounds like something clicked.
Well, there was a lot of, at that point in time, there were a lot of turmoil in the UFW. The split had already begun to happen. You had the in the field offices, you had them beginning to advocate more openly for stability, for paying of staff, that we couldn't have this continual turnover, that if we were really interested in having farm workers be part of the leadership of the union, they weren't going to work for $5 a week. There had to be some stability. So that fissure had already begun. At La Paz, you had a whole other thing going on, where Caesar is now talking about community. He's got this garden going on there for sustainability and all of that. He's starting to think about, well, the way, if you don't have salaries, maybe you create a community that people want to live in. He was really struggling with management issues, trying to manage the chaos, in some ways, of the union with the pension plan, the medical plan, and all these things that were had been created out of concepts, but now you have to manage and you have to produce on. And it was, and some of the problems were legendary. But Caesar is trying at La Paz to create a model, in some ways, that he thought could be replicated at in other places. It never happened. It probably couldn't ever have happened. But this wedding that I described to you was at that critical point, and Caesar saw it as a way, in some ways, to actually help build community. And in some ways, it was this whole split between what people wanted to do in the field offices and what people were doing in La Paz really came to a head shortly thereafter.
But this whole idea of being able to communicate with people and get them to relax and do that kind of thing.
So I had seen it in a house meeting, because the purpose of a house meeting really was to be able to organize people in a comfortable environment where they were not feel threatened. And so the whole theory of house meetings that Fred and Caesar had used for years to build the union was built on safeness, a safe place where people could really talk about things and where you could really engage. And then I think that some of these social aspects, Caesar saw also the potential of doing that as well. And he really was trying to build this whole community spirit at La Paz. It never happened, really, for some other reasons as well. But it didn't happen.
Okay. Now, you were with the union over 10 years. In what capacity were you working?
I did lots of different things in the union. I worked on the boycott a number of different times. I directed the boycott nationally. I directed offices in Oxnard. I directed our strike and our offices in Hollister and Gilroy. I was an organizer during the Gallo elections and led the number of the organizing drives once the agricultural labor relations law was passed in 1975. So I had a real variety of jobs within the union. Some I was at La Paz, and some I was out in the field offices, and some I was in cities, and doing a variety of different things. As most people did in UFW, you kind of worked in different areas.
Well, you worked for over 10 years for $5
mm-hmm.
a week. I mean, how'd you do it?
I look back and I think, wow, how did we do it? First, I mean, you learn to hustle in using that word in the best sense. You learn to, when you were in cities, you learned who your supporters were. In fact, my wife, I met because her mother was the person in the Oakland area that you went to when you needed a meal. She had 12 kids, and she was a Catholic family, and UFW people were always coming into her household. And that's how I got to know my wife, because she was one of the 12 kids. And I knew her mother for several years before I knew my future wife. This was 1975, and we were in, was it 75? Maybe 73. And we had a huge strike in the grapes throughout California. And in a lot of the rural areas, they're arresting all the strikers, they're arresting the UFW leadership. And so the union had this plan to bring religious people down and have them get arrested, to bring public attention on what was going on with the court system and the justice system and the police down there. And so my wife's mother was one of these people. I asked if she would go down and get arrested. And the rap was, you go down, you get arrested, they'll release you, and you go back home, and yada, yada, yada. Well, she got arrested. She was in jail for 14 days. Her father was. My wife's father was pissed. He was an official of the painters union, had been up to that time very supportive of the UFW, till his wife got arrested and was in jail 14 days. But that I had that relationship with Annie's mom first. And so in answer to your question, there were people like that. We were on food stamps. We hustled food. You combined resources, and you did it. And I never really thought about it. There was candidly a liberating feeling not thinking about anything like that. You worked. It only as you got older did you think about it. Gilbert Padilla, as he got older, he started thinking about, gosh, I've worked in UFW for whatever it had been at that point for him, 20 years. He had done the CSO for 10 or so before then. He was now in his 60s. What do I have? People begin thinking about that as a short-term commitment now became a decade or more. People started thinking about that more, what was going to happen. But early on, you didn't. It was really liberating. It wasn't a sacrifice. I mean, it really wasn't. I mean, it just was what it was. And I don't think anybody that thought it was a sacrifice didn't stay very long. So you were surrounded by like-minded thinkers.
Now, you eventually left. I mean, what was going on? Let's stop. I'm fine.
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
We're good.
Yeah. I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay. Moving into the next segment here. Now, Larry, you were there for 10 years, and you said that, you know, people in the short run were thinking, this is liberating, this is great, and weren't thinking too much about the future. But what was going on with you in terms of after a decade with the farm workers?
Well, to be honest with you, it wasn't really until the end, and I was now 33. I've done 11 years that I started thinking about it more. But to be honest with you, had there not been the problems within the UFW, I could have seen staying another 10, 15, 20 years or staying forever. I mean, I never... The work was so fulfilling, and you really felt that you were doing things that were really making a difference. You were making a difference with labor. You were making a difference with poor people. You were making a difference with farm workers, be they Mexican farm workers in California or black farm workers in Florida. You were really doing social change. There were no questions in your mind that what you were doing in your life was making a difference. It was only when things kind of began breaking apart and you saw people leaving and you saw people being purged and you saw the dark side of the union, which I'm sure has been documented many times in many discussions, did you start thinking, well, is it going to happen to me? And for me, and I'll tell you the story. I'll tell you the story because it was kind of a, you know, everybody's, the purges in the union had probably happened for many, many years, even prior to my involvement in the union. And there was a kind of a pattern where people were sometimes red baited out, asked to leave, different kinds of things. And it was part of Caesar keeping power. And when it happened to other people, you could almost justify it. And I mean, to be honest with you, I was very close to Caesar at times where we were eliminating people on staff who he felt were not loyal. And I've written about that, so it's pretty well documented. And you'd always rationalize, well, that person didn't do this or that person knew that. And but you're now seeing, and we're talking about 1980, 79, 80, 81, that period of time, really some of the top leadership of the union leaving. Eliseo Medina leaving, having a dispute and leaving. And Eliseo was the heir apparent. Marshall Gans leaving. Jessica Govea leaving. Jerry Cohen, a brilliant attorney, leaving. Gilbert Padilla leaving. I mean, and all having their stories and disputes with Caesar, and all of them now are being viewed as the enemy from the inside, which they weren't. Different perspective, different opinions. But because the work was so fulfilling and you're doing so good things, you put up with it. And so even though you had disagreed. So we were actually assigned to Hollister. And a strike had been going on in the Garlic. And the strike got settled, a very successful settlement of the strike. And following that strike, the worker leadership that were down there started organizing these other ranches. And I was the staff person there. And candidly, I mean, I'm given a lot of credit for organizing these places. I should have no credit. All we did was direct these farm worker leaders, and they organized these places, and we won. I think we had 27 elections and won 26 of them. It was awesome. One right after another. And one day I get a call from Caesar, and he says, I want you to come to La Paz. I want to talk to you. So, all right. And so I'll be there tomorrow. And, you know, I'm telling my wife, wow, you know, I think we have figured out a great way of organizing. It didn't take a whole lot of resources because there was some criticism of organizing, taking a lot of personnel resources and stuff. We kind of figured out a model. It was the worker leaders and them doing it and kind of directing it. And so I drive up to La Paz from Hollister, my old Valiant, and I'm going all through this of thinking how excited Caesar was going to be when I told him all the story of how it was done and stuff. And I really thought he was going to pick my brain. Well, I got into his office, which I had been in hundreds of times before, and I knew it was different. As soon as I walked in, he had a tight, kind of, his lips were tight, and he asked me, who are you working for? I said, well, I was kind of like taken back, and I said, what do you mean, who I'm working for? He says, who are you working for? You working for Moscow? I swear to God, this is a true story. And I said, well, no, I'm working for you, I'm working for the union. He says, well, I will determine where we organize. I will determine what branches we do, and nobody but me will do that. So I said, all right. Drove back. I told my wife, it's over. I said, it's over. We got to figure out what's the next step. So I'm 33 now, and so that's the point that I'm starting thinking, okay, I'm 33. Who's going to hire me? You know, I could stay, maybe do this another 5-6 years. Then I'm 38. 39, it's harder. But it was what had happened to others in the past happened to me then. And it was like, wow. Now, so, you know, within 2 or 3 months, I asked for a leave. I was given a leave, and knowing that the chances of me going back. But it was hard because, you know, I mean, everything of who I was in my adult years had been formed within the UFW, and in a bat of an eye, it was over.
What was behind it?
Paranoia. And the building of all of that. And it was a pattern that had Caesar, with all of his wonderful qualities, and in balance, the good far outweighs the bad. The curiosity, the discipline, the motivational skills, inspirational, for lack of a better word, all of that, he also was a paranoid person. He was paranoid. For what reason, I don't know. His obsession with detail, of being in control of things, became a problem for him. I mean, I was in charge once for the logistics of convention that we were doing of farm workers, and it had, I don't know, maybe 5, 7, 10,000 farm workers at convention in Fresno. I couldn't make a decision about what type of napkins we were going to use. I mean, his attention to detail was bizarre and abnormal and destructive. And so I think in some ways what happened with Caesar is when he could control things, he was at his best. But the union, through partly because, well, a good portion because of his work and the work of others, expanded to the point of an individual couldn't control it. You had to have others. You had to have lieutenants. You had to have other people, and with different ideas. And the leaders that are able to take that leap are the real are also leaders. They have different kind of skills. He couldn't take that leap. Somebody described to me earlier today that one of the things about really successful people are like C students who hire B students who direct A students, and they're the ones that are really successful. Let's say Caesar was a C student. He had a hard time doing B and A, and he needed to be in an organization. For him to think he knew how he should set up systems to manage a pension plan or a medical plan or the nuances of a hiring hall or that, it was outside of his, even though he was extremely well-read, it was outside of his ability, outside of anybody's ability to do that. No one could do that. But yet he thought he could. Maybe because of his curiosity, I can solve this problem. He also suffered a little bit from one size fits all. If we're going to have a hiring hall in Salinas, maybe we have the same type of hiring hall in Delano. Well, the industries are different. The workforces are different. And he had an inability, because he was trying to manage all of this, he wanted it all to be clean and organized. And that was his downfall in many ways. That was one of his unfortunate legacies, is that he cast such a shadow over everybody else in the union, no one was going to challenge him. No one was going to take him on. It was Caesar's way or the highway. Some people took the highway voluntarily. Some people took the highway involuntarily. But it was the same highway, and the highway led out. And it was unfortunate because in that period of time, say from 1965 to 1980, that period of time, the UFW attracted the very best activists in this country, the very best, and trained them. And if one of the real legacies now is seeing have all those people who work there are doing unbelievable things all over the country. It just kind of, because they took the highway, those highways led to different places where they were able to do other things. It's a tragedy in many ways. I don't think it will ever diminish his role historically. It's too big. He was too critical. No one really wants to challenge that. In fact, it really wasn't until the documentation project that even people talked about it outside of hushed rooms, where people would. And part of it is you're really protective of that. I mean, I'm really protective of the UFW and Caesar and all the good stuff we do. So it's really hard to talk outside the family about that, the downside. I mean, my own family, there's things I don't talk about. They're not everything's perfect. There's things that, but I'll never talk about those outside the family. And I think we all felt the same way with UFW. So it's only now been, you know, years later that people are even beginning to probe that. And it's still, the nerves are still difficult. And it says, because it was so important, because what we were doing was so real, that what makes it hard. But so there are the two sides.
So how were you able to reckon of being dismissed and getting to a point now where you really have perspective?
Well, it took years. I mean, it really did take years. For me, the first year or two were just, okay, I left the UFW. I was now 33. I had three kids now. Fourth on the way, had no car, had no money. My resume existed at UFW. And so, you know, can I make a living? Can I do these things? Of course, my parents had never been supportive of anything, connected with that. it took a while, and it took a while to see, candidly, to see, you know, when you're acquiring skills, when you're doing things, you not realize you're acquiring skills. It's only later, you say, oh, God, where did I learn to do that? Well, it was UFW. It wasn't until later that I realized that 11 years I did there was the greatest internship I could ever have. I learned things I could never have learned. I understand politics and community organizing that I could have gone to school for 100 years and never learned, really. What I learned to be able to expose to quality organizers, whether it be Leroy or Fred or Marshall or Caesar or Ellie Sale, was invaluable. And so in time, I would be asked to do things partly because of my reputation in the UFW, and that so became easier. But opening up to talk about it was really difficult. Because there was, we weren't talking about a historical figure necessarily who had died. We were talking about a current situation where you have a union that exists and farm workers who have need of a union and have a need of a union to be powerful and strong. And that union, unfortunately, not living up to what we had wanted it to be. But you didn't want to do anything that was even going to hurt that. It's only gotten comfortable as one has talked about it more. It's still difficult. When I talk to people about the UFW, I seldom go into the negative part, even though it's as relevant as a positive part, I mean, historically. But it's a very difficult place to go to, even, I mean, all these years later. Because I think that's true for most people. Some people have gone past that very easily, but for me, it's been very difficult.
I'd like to wind this up in a little bit now, but what advice would you give to somebody that wants to go out and change the world and become an organizer? I mean, what would you tell them, given where we are these days, 2000?
Well, first, is I do believe that anybody can make a difference. The trick is doing it. The trick is not talking about it, but taking action and doing it. And the things are not necessarily predictable. You have to be able to adapt as you do it. Circumstances change. And I also think you start at the local level. All good politics, all good organizing starts at the local level. So to change the world, you know, I mean, it sounds very trite, but, you know, to change the world, you should start with your own neighborhood and deal with things that you feel impassioned about. I think people look, if an organizer is good, that organizer has to demonstrate their commitment first. You can't organize, as I said kind of earlier, you can't organize unless you've been willing to do it. And most organizers, the organizing that's being taught right now is a surgical kind of antiseptic organizing where you're trying to identify others to do it. So you're trying to become an enabler of others. So a lot of the organizers are kind of in the background, and they're using people to kind of be the front and to organize. And that was totally different than the UFW. The UFW said, you're on the front lines. Fred organized in the Mexican community himself. It became a lot easier when he had Caesar working with him as well. But he didn't shy away from it. He wasn't afraid. He wasn't afraid that he was going to be criticized because he was white and didn't speak Spanish. He just did it. And through doing it, you develop, you show your sincerity, you're able to, and people are able to respond accordingly. And I think that's one of the greatest lessons of the UFW is that the lesson of self, living what you say you're gonna do, and not just talking about it, and whether it's lifestyle changes or whatever. So don't know if that answers your question or not.
Anything else, Larry, that's on...
Just a couple of things, I think, that would be helpful, I mean, to get a sense of Caesar. I mean, he went into this, and I don't know who's going to talk about it, so I'll mention it here, and you can edit it out if you like. Caesar became very interested in metaphysical and things and the power of healing, which I thought personally, and I still do, very bizarre, very bizarre. My wife went through some very difficult medical problems when we were in La Paz, and we had to come back to the Bay Area because there were better doctors here. But Caesar actually felt he could heal her through his hands. And it was really bizarre for me. I could never get into that. And I think some people actually believe it, and maybe there's some truth in it. I could never get my whole head around that. And the whole thing, there was a period once at La Paz early on, not early on, I'd say early on in the breakup, really, where all of us were brought to the North Unit. This was a part of La Paz that was in the north, and it was a building that had been renovated. And it was a community meeting, and it was in the evening, and he had the lights turned out. And he was saying that he was asking people if they could see his aura. You know, like how Christ is drawn with his aura around him? He said that was a real phenomenon, and that everybody had it, and some people had more power to exhibit than others. And there were people there who said they saw it. I didn't see it, and I thought this was kooky, and this is a labor union, and we should be talking about organizing workers and not Caesar's aura. That was as bizarre as I could imagine on one hand. Yet, my wife's mother was dying of cancer, and she had been arrested in the UFW. You know, she was one of these families that took people in. She was not UFW staff. She wasn't any of that. She was a volunteer like everybody else. She was dying of cancer, and she was in the hospital in Alameda. And despite Caesar's unbelievable schedule, made time to drive up from Salinas with these drivers and stuff, went to see her, and spent an hour or two with her as she was dying. Why? I mean, you got to put all these pieces together about Caesar. I mean, this bizarre thing on one hand, seeing the aura, and this incredibly human part of him taking time out of an incredible schedule to deal with this woman who wasn't even full-time staff when she was dying. It was, to me, it was absolutely... I could never pull all that together. And so that's one of the reasons that I think a lot of us that spent as much time as we did in UFW have a difficult time trying to gain perspective of this very complicated, very complex person who we're likely never to see again.